Back When is sponsored by Siwi, the National Trust's photo printing partner. Every image captures a story. Siwi's support means the National Trust can protect our nation's memories by caring for and sharing our vast collection of historic photographs. Through our work together, we're uncovering precious and previously unseen images for everyone to enjoy. Discover our work snapshotting 200 years of history. Search online for Siwi, that's C-E-W-E, and the National Trust.
One of the things that struck me was that it was both very ordinary and yet it was at the same time extraordinary. It was ordinary in the sense that this is a semi-detached Edwardian house. It's furnished and decorated in a very typical way for the period. But the fact that that then survives for 70 years, practically unchanged, is extraordinary.
Seven Blythe Grove sits on a suburban street in a classic market town. A family home bought and paid for through hard work. It was lived in until the 1980s, yet step through the front door and you're stepping back in time. The semi-detached house is now an unusual heritage site that visitors can come and see. But why this house? What was it about the family that lived here that drove them to live in a bygone era long after the world around them had changed? Have you ever imagined being a fly on the wall of history? Join me for an inside view of the stories of people, places, and moments that made us. I'm historian James Grasby. Lean in for a tale from time back when. I've arrived in Worksop, Nottinghamshire, a very handsome market town in the Midlands. I've left the station, Victorian station, behind, headed up the hill into the leafy suburbs. And this is a very different sort of place. Pretty houses, villas really, detached. This is the beginning of the 20th century, the Edwardian era, I guess. Now, I can see a promising sign which I think beckons me, Mr. Straw's house. But why should I be coming to what seems to be a very straightforward sort of house? And who is Mr. Straw? I'm going to go and have a look through this rather elegant cast iron gate, a couple of steps leading up to an extremely gracious front door with a number 7. I'm going to knock on the door and see if my friend, the senior collections and house officer, Daniel Lander Brown, is here.
Hello.
Daniel, I'm very pleased to see you. I'm bowled over by your house. It's very handsome and it's quite dark. You've brought me in to what I can only describe as a sort of cacophony of things and colours and surfaces and textures. It is full of stuff. This is entering into a different time, a different world.
It's one of the things that makes this property unique. If the family were to return at any point, they can put their hand on any object in any drawer, any cupboard. Their belongings remain as they left it.
Danielle, my eyes are just becoming accustomed to this dimness. I'm beginning to see where I am. This is a time capsule. It feels like a little glimpse of the 1920s.
I can tell you exactly when it is. If you come into the dining room.
So going through an oak door, over some very richly coloured carpets, a dining room table laid for a meal. Every last bit of paraphernalia appears to be in this room.
If you look to the right of the fireplace here, you'll see a calendar that dates to 1932, which is when William Sr. passed away, and it has been hanging there since.
Oh.
The family have kept, if you like, mementos or pieces that are poignant to them and their family story. So things like the pipes that hang to the left of the fireplace there, they belong to William Sr. also. And then behind those is a calendar that actually dates to 1939, which is when Florence, the mother, passes away.
Seven Blythe Grove was the much-loved home of William Straw Sr., wife Florence, and their two sons. William Straw Sr. makes his money in the grocery business in the 1880s through to the early 1900s, trading out of a shop in Worksop's Market Place. The family live above the shop initially, as is customary at the time. But he eventually moves his family, wife Florence, and grown-up sons William Jr. and Walter into one of the middle-class villas in a very nice part of town in 1923.
Number 7 was built around 1903, 1904, so very early Edwardian. But really, our family story are earlier than that. Florence and William Sr. are mid to late Victorians, and then their boys, William Jr., Walter and David, who unfortunately lost in infancy, are more Edwardian gentlemen.
The family has 11 years in their home together before William Sr., father, dies in 1932 at the age of 67. Florence dies 5 years after her husband in 1939. After their deaths, the sons live in the property together. Neither marries, no one moves in, no one moves on. The Batchelor brothers barely change a thing for decades more, and so the house is left today almost as if time has stood still from the day William Sr., father, dies. Walter, the younger brother who runs the shop, survives until 1976. William Jr., the older brother, survives until 1990. It is he who runs the house.
He would have seen it as his home, but he would have still seen it as his parents' house and would have seen his mother in every space.
A reluctance to make changes as a mark of respect to his parents is coupled with an Edwardian upbringing that seems to survive throughout William and Walter's lives. Edwardian dress is still very formal. Women are still wearing corsets, men, three-piece suits. And although the Edwardian era is seen as a transitional period between the strict Victorian era and the modern world, William and Walter live by the rules their parents had lived by. A strict class system and an exhaustingly long list of social do's and don'ts.
So there's lots of things playing into the house as to why it seems to settle into that sort of almost stopping in the 1930s.
I can't wait to see more. It's utterly fascinating, isn't it? And so we set off on a tour of the house to learn more about the family. The spaces are tight and dim, and I'm conscious how precious each and every item is.
Please do be careful of the coats that hang. They belonged to all the boys in the house, and the one nearest the kitchen, we believe, belonged to Father and has been hanging there since his passing in 1932.
That is very moving, isn't it? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. 2 cloth caps, 3 what look like sort of trilbies. I mean, what is very striking about this is the everydayness of it, the ordinariness of it. Down through another oak door. Into the kitchen. Danielle, I'm very surprised to see that. I mean, above my head, there is a bellboard. But this is a bell system so that in the front drawing room, the dining room, the drawing room, and the bathroom, along with 2 bedrooms, you could press a button and call a member of staff.
It certainly shows the grandeur of the house and the aspirations, if you like, of the Straw family as part of that emerging middle class. The emerging middle class were a group of people that were able to own their own businesses. They were still earning their money, but much more in lighter trades, and were able to therefore employ people from the working class. They were all aspiring to that aristocratical type of living. And so you see that very much represented in their homes and their houses and the businesses and the lifestyles they had. And you see that in the Straw family home here as well. You see that part of their life represented throughout the house, from the decor to the way they lived in it, the fact that they could afford to go on annual holiday. Just the amount of clutter represents this. It's that idea of having decorations and pretty things for pretty things' sake. As part of the working class, if it didn't have a useful purpose, you couldn't afford to buy it.
So what you're telling me is Mr. Straw has enough money to move into a house of this scale designed to be run by servants.
William Sr. Originally buys the grocer's business that he runs in conjunction with his elder brother Benjamin with some money that they borrowed from their parents. The business was doing so well, he later went on to buy his brother out. And this is when he met Florence Ann Winks, the daughter of a local butcher and councillor that lived above her father's butcher shop directly opposite his grocer's shop. By 1903, the family are doing so well that he goes on to buy the building he's trading from, the access route to Side, the White Hart Hotel next door. He also buys some of the cottages behind. He purchases some land from the Duke of Newcastle, which he turns into gentlemen's gardens or allotments. And it's during this time that the family are really part of showing their status in society. Florence actually attends the Duke of Newcastle's coming of age ball. They're moving in those sort of higher echelons of society.
Worksop is known as the gateway to the dukeries. There are five dukes' estates nearby, and William's business is delivering to them as well as the townspeople. William and Florence are flying high, and the purchase of Seven Blythe Grove is the epitome of that success. And Florence, a follower of fashion, is making sure that's reflected inside the house too, with the very latest trends.
So as we go up the stairway here, you'll notice the Egyptian-style carpet.
With some very obvious motifs that are familiar. Hieroglyphs, Egyptian hieroglyphs.
In 1922, Tutankhamun's tomb was discovered. It influenced interior design, it influenced artists, it influenced even clothing. It's sort of the start of that shift as well from that Art Nouveau into Art Deco. But it was absolutely a global phenomenon that influenced many things at that time. And it's in 1923 that Florence decorates the house. So it's only a year on. However, you know, with such an expensive carpet, if you notice once you get to the middle landing here, that it actually stops and changes. We talk about that Florence being part of the emerging middle class and the house being here for show. So your guests would have come through, seen the beautiful stained glass windows. They would have been taken to the fine parlour. But then you would not get much further. And so that's why it stops on this landing.
That's fascinating. So for Florence, this was her pride and joy.
Florence very much wanted to make her statement on the family home. If we make our way to the front bedroom, you can see her influence throughout.
So we've come up a straight flight of stairs onto a half landing. This is the principal front room.
This is the master bedroom of the house. However, it doesn't appear to be the parents' bedroom. But even in this space, as one of the boys' rooms, you still see Florence's influence.
It's a lovely room. Floral carpets, chintz curtains.
Florence's influence is very noticeable in younger son Walter's bedroom. But there is paraphernalia from his time running the shop.
I'm intrigued to know why you'd want to have huge canisters of tea and tea measuring scoops in your bedroom.
It's that reminder, if you like, of a time of probably working with his father. A bit like other objects that have been kept in the house, like the calendars downstairs. You know, it's that sentimentality of keeping your family close and being able to remember those times.
How lovely. It's very touching, isn't it? I want to see more.
So William's bedroom is right at the top of the house and effectively in the servants' quarters.
After the First World War, the older brother William Jr. lives and teaches in London. He returns to Worksop and Seven Blythe Grove in 1939 when his mother dies. His attic bedroom is full of books.
A very full room. I like the gumboots by the end of the bed. Oh, behind me, an enormous bookcase. Hundreds of books. Wow.
William collected antiquarian and reference books. And in his bedroom, he surrounds himself there under the beds and in the bottom of his wardrobe, which he's relegated to the landing.
The bookcase is opposite a window and the books are protected by drapes that William makes himself. There are other areas in the house where you can see the lengths he goes to ensure his collection is looked after.
In the parlour, there is a sampler that his mother made when she was 11 and a half. And on the back, he's put a note to let us know that it shouldn't be kept in direct sunlight.
It's almost as if William, the older brother and keeper of the house, is preparing his collection to be given to the nation. But this kind of place, although aspirational for the Straws, is far from the historically significant buildings and interiors you'd normally see preserved for visitors. Neither is it a personality house once lived in by a literary or a scientific great, or an architecturally significant building, or a structure that showcases our industrial heritage. And yet, it's hugely important and significant to our nation's history, a story of relatively ordinary lives.
I remember incredibly clearly, as if it was yesterday, when I got a phone call sitting in my office in Clumber, 5 o'clock, December evening, cold and dark. And the solicitor said, "I'm phoning to let you know that the National Trust has been left a considerable legacy by a gentleman in Worksop, together with the contents of his house. Would you like to come and see?" I'm Simon Murray. I was previously the Chief Operating Officer of the National Trust, and at the time of the acquisition of Mr. Straw's house, I was Senior Curator. And I was the first person from the National Trust to walk through the door of 7 Blythe Grove in 1990. We went in, it was freezing cold, it was dark. And I thought, blimey, here was this place that it was absolutely stacked with stuff. I was shown into the front room and shown that, you know, there was the pipe of Father Straw, who died in 1932. There was his slippers. There was the newspaper in 1932. And the idea of the story began to unravel. But I have to say that at that time, you know, I was an expert in things like fine art, architecture, you know. And I wasn't sure about this at all. I took a couple of colleagues to see it a couple of days later, and we started to ask questions. And it became apparent that actually there was no authentic house like this, of either a sort of terraced or a semi-detached house, the most common form of housing in this country, which was preserved as it was. Because we preserve things generally of the aristocracy and the wealthy. They make good things. They make great wallpapers. They have Chippendale furniture. They have paintings by Reynolds. Most of the stuff that exists in working or lower middle class houses has not been made to last a great length of time. And it just disappears. And fashions change. People move in and out of houses all the time. Whereas, of course, aristocratic houses, they stay there for centuries. So the fact that here was a house which had remained virtually unchanged since 1923 was extraordinary. Very quickly, we begin to understand that it was an extraordinary survival.
From the ground floor to these attics, it's a time capsule, Danielle, here, isn't it? So what happened? Why was it that the family were so keen to keep it all together?
The family sort of did resist the advancements of technology. Walter recalls his father's opinion on the wireless. He said, you know, "Well, I suppose it's all right for people who are ill or who can't read, but I don't think we need one." William Jr., he noted often in his diaries, you know, "I have no wireless because I dislike having my home invaded by people who chatter, shout, sing, and from time to time play upon the flute." But it doesn't mean that they were recluses or hid themselves away from the world. We have some really insightful audio diaries. If you have a listen to this one, James, this is a second cousin to the boys, Betty, talking about how Walter, once he'd opened up the shop, would pop across to her grandmother's place to get a daily fix of what was going on.
"He always chattered. Yeah. You know, I wasn't sort of ignored at all when he visited Grandma, which was every morning. He, as soon as he'd opened the shop and the staff had arrived, he would come across, he would listen to the 8 o'clock news, and then he would go back to work. And, of course, we used to see him again at tea time. He would come across again and listen to the 6 o'clock news in the evening because they didn't have a wireless.
No,
and
I
he was most interested in the goings-on, of course."
And that was Walter.
Walter did embrace technology in a certain way, you know, but the pair were very different in their lifestyles, in their personalities.
While Walter appears to embrace technology slightly more than his older brother, it seems he might have liked to embrace marriage too, although William, again, has other ideas.
Walter went dancing with a lady friend that was his second cousin. I believe that William didn't approve of the relationship, disapproved of the marriage of a second cousin.
Further audio diaries recorded with people who knew the Straws at around the time the house is bequeathed to the National Trust reveal more about Walter's desire to marry.
There were suggestions he was on close to getting engaged at one time, but Walter sort of, William...
Put the kibosh on it.
So in that clip we heard that Walter might have liked to have married, but William dissuaded him, and perhaps his motivation for that was so as not to bring in someone new who'd bring outside change to the house.
So William Jr. was definitely the most adverse of the brothers to change. He carefully preserved and cared for his family possessions, and with a view of leaving the collection to the National Trust, he certainly wouldn't have appreciated that intrusion or change. And so having not married, it is one of the reasons that the house remains as it does today. Had either brother married, probably that, you know, they would have had children, they would have come in, redecorated to the fashions of those times, and you'd have seen a shift change within the house again.
And are there people in the town who remember them?
So, yeah, the family is still within living memory. In fact, one of our long-standing volunteers here, Sheila, remembers the Straw brothers. We can head down to chat with her now.
Oh, wow.
And so we head back downstairs to meet Sheila in the kitchen.
Sheila, you're so lovely to come round. How do you do?
How do you do? I'm Sheila Foster.
Sheila knew William Jr. and Walter from 1938 until they passed away, Walter in 1976 and William Jr. in 1990.
Sheila, how do you explain why Mr. Straw wanted to give the contents of his house to the National Trust? What was it about it that he wanted?
I think he wanted people to see things that, one, had belonged to his beloved mother and father, that, two, there were things that he'd saved for years and years and years which were of historical interest to people. And yet, I think if William could come back, he would order you all out because he wouldn't want people walking in his beloved mother and father's house.
So it was a sort of a monument to them.
When father died in 1932, mother said the house must remain as it was when father was alive. And then when mother died in 1939, William and Walter decided, I think it was more William, because Walter always gave in to him. William decided that the house must remain as it was when their mother and father were alive. And William got so engrossed in this that he didn't want anything to change. If it wasn't here when father was alive, it wasn't to be here now. William was really, really the apple of his mother's eye. So it was a great loss to William, even though he'd lived in London and he didn't return home till after his mother had died. And then he sets about making sure that everything will remain as it was. He wanted the house to stay as a shrine for his parents.
That's beautifully put. What a pleasure to meet you. You are lovely to come out.
Thank you very much.
Back down the hall, the oak stairs. Danielle, thank you very much indeed. That was fascinating. It's fascinating to hear, isn't it? A first-hand account. Somebody who'd actually met them and seen them and was part of the community around them. I mean, thinking of the era that it spans, I mean, the boys were born at the end of the reign of Queen Victoria. They lived through the First World War, the Great Depression, the Second World War. They saw the advent of flight, of the first computer, of the telephone, of electric light, of nuclear power, of the atomic bomb. And then right up into the 60s, they saw the Vietnam War. I mean, the pace of change and the era that they lived in was quite astonishing.
They were very aware of the world around them and how it was changing and the pace it was changing at. And it may be one of the factors that almost is holding William back, that, you know, looking back, a bit of nostalgia within himself of a life, if you like, or a lifestyle that was being lost with such rapid change. So to be able to leave this archive, this story for the nation, to be able to learn from and remember and to reminisce with, in some ways was very forward thinking whilst looking back at the same time.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Back When. You can send us your ratings and reviews if you'd like, and we have two nature podcasts, Wild Tales and Nature Fix, you could check out too. For now, from me, James Grasby, goodbye.
This podcast is sponsored by Siwi, Europe's leading photo printing company. Every image you capture tells a story. Discover ideas for curating and creating your special memories and unique gifts for loved ones. From high-quality, personalised photo books to wall art made from your favourite photos. Head to Siwi, that's CEWE.co.uk, and start creating your story.